So thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you, Herr Kardinal, that you came from Rome. And I try to propose now my paper without touching the new document. Between failure and jubilation, contrary tendencies in the pastoral care of marriage. Firstly, observation of the situation. This symposium entitled, "And God Saw It Was Very Good," comes at a time when, theologically speaking, the debate concerning marriage and family is highly fraught. What today would the divine gaze focus upon? If the method adopted by pastoral theology is that of seeing, judging, and acting, the first step, that is, pastoral seeing or pastoral observation, raises an initial question. Can the reality we are seeing still be regarded as very good? Is not the case that what we see today is in fact a multiplicity of conjugal unions that in common parlance are called marriage, although they deviate to not inconsiderable degree from what marriage was in paradise? As for the so-called alternative forms of marriage, cohabitation, the patchwork families, second, third, and fourth marriage, same-sex marriage, do they still fit with the Bible's original, "And God saw that it was very good"? Sorry. In a situation of such upheaval, it may be helpful to widen our view of things. 2 years ago, I was involved in an academic exchange in West Africa, in Benin, a country where Christianity was introduced only some 150 years ago. Among the participants at the lecture and colloquium on Jesus of Nazareth were two boys aged 10 and 12, who, though unaccompanied by their parents, followed the proceedings attentively and wrote their class notes just like the adults. Later, I asked the older whether his parents had agreed to him to participate the week of theology. Yes, he said. I asked if their parents were believers. He answered, yes, of course. After all, they were married in the church. The next day, I met the African boy's father and told him what I've asked to his son and what he had answered. The father confirmed proudly what the boy had told to me. Yes, we are believers. We are married in the church 10 years ago. This small example illustrates an entirely different approach to the reality of marriage. For these African Christians in Benin, being married in church is the strongest visible expression and evident proof of their being Christians in a country where 50% of the population still belongs to the voodoo cult, where the snake temples are carefully maintained by voodoo families, and where fetishes still have an unbroken influence in everyday life, even in people driving on the roads. In Benin, persons who profess their faith in Jesus in the Catholic Church are not content merely to observe first the traditional marriage and second the civil marriage, which in that country automatically precede the ecclesial and sacramental marriage. Such persons also make a lifelong commitment in the presence of the church in order to be regarded henceforth as believers. In this way, after the two preceding and obligatory marriages, mariage coutumier, mariage d'état, being married in the church is something believing parents and their children are very proud of it. It is a publicity lived witness to their faith. In Europe, however, as a result of individualism and the desire for autonomy, we can observe a changed attitude to sacramental marriage, so much that Christians themselves question its legitimacy. In the last 30 years, two huge changes of orientation can be seen in the pastoral care of marriage, and we shall now turn to examine the arguments on which they are based. So I came to my second point. changes in the German theology of pastoral care of marriage since the council. A first step, gradualism and the pastoral care of marriage. In the wake of the council and the attention it gave to the personal married love of the partners, the 1980 Synod of Bishops on Marriage and the Family introduced a pastoral principle that was summed up in the term of gradualism. What does it mean? So, pastorally spoken. Joseph Ratzinger, in his pastoral letter to the Archdiocese of München und Freising, reflects in some detail on the principle of gradualism, since it had considerable influence on the first part of the Propositiones. I quote, "The third topic, gradualism, thus formulated, was a new idea put forward by the Synod. It became one of its all-pervading perspectives. The gradualism takes up the theme of life as a journey. It gives its concrete substance in the shape of moral understanding and praxis. The whole Christian path is spoken of a conversio, a conversion, but such conversion consists in a series of steps." He goes on, "Gradualism is a dynamic process that advances gradually, integrating God's gifts and the challenges of his absolute definitive love in the entirety of man's personal and social life. Individual believers and people and their civilization need a patient pedagogy that will lead them forward from what they have already received from the Mysterium Christi to full knowledge of the mystery and its full integration in their lives and conduct. In this way, it is made possible in the spirit of the love and the fear of God, but without anxiety, perturbatio, for the human hearts and lives to be gradually liberated, eventually becoming fully opened up to Christ." In the course of the 1980 Synod of Bishops, this principle of gradualism was applied in the context of Humane Vitae to those Christian married couples in particular who, I quote Ratzinger, who, in spite of a sincere will, feel incapable, because of their weakness and objective difficulties, of fulfilling and obeying the moral norms taught by the Church. In this decision, Ratzinger sees the correspondence of Church teaching and concrete pedagogy that accompanies man in his long life pilgrimage, helping him to be open to divine guidance without rescinding the challenges of Humane Vitae. Together with the Synod Fathers, he rejects the possibility of abandoning Church teaching in the actual practice. It would be schizophrenic, he says. Rather, it is the question of bringing out the inner dimension of this norm, which is itself a path and an invitation, and the norm's humanity and human justice, which spring from the fact that it is not a human invention. Those, however, who do not set out on this path, who argue that it is only a path and therefore not binding, are turning their back on it and on the opportunity it offers for people to find themselves at a better and deeper level. The foregoing shows that in 1980, the principle of gradualism, particularly in relation to broken marriages, or rather marriages made in the Church and subsequently broken, is understood as a pastoral way of bringing those concerned step by step, gradually, from Latin gradus, step, out of the state of brokenness and helping them to take a path of conversion. The goal of this gradual process and path of conversion is ultimately the discovery of a new and deepened encounter with God, re-echoing creation's primal joy. 35 years later, within the framework of the 2015 Synod of Bishops in Rome, the principle of gradualism was, as it were, newly discussed and welcomed. Commentaries were written on it. What then is the context of these interpretations? By way of illustration, we may refer to the work of the Vienna pastoral theologian Paul Zulehner. Shortly after the Synod of Bishops in November 2015, he gave a lecture assessing its pastoral theological significance. Like Ratzinger in his reflections on the 1980 Synod of Bishops, Zulehner addresses the principle of gradualism in some details. He sees the Relatio Synodi, so this final document on the 2015 Synod of Bishops, as a decisive pastoral turning point, moving away from the indissoluble marriage covenant and marriage as an institution towards the person. Significant for Zulehner here is the distinction drawn in paragraph 85 on the Synod's concluding document, namely that an objectively sinful state is not always a subjective sin. The crucial thing, by contrast, is that the person himself clears his conscience before God. The task of pastoral care here now, in this case, is to support this process and accompany it with the power of the gospel. The church's role is to accept the results of this process. It is here, according to Zulehner, that the principle of gradualism makes itself felt, a stepwise process of maturing that becomes aware from the ideal of pure love, extolling the ideal case, as it were, of sacramental marriage in all its beauty, while at the same time being aware of its frailty. For Zulehner, gradualism works itself out a dynamic of growth. Pastoral care concentrates on seeing the good in the actual life situation, in cohabitation, in civil marriage, second marriage, and so on. In this way, he says, the pastoral care of marriage, operating according to the gradualism principle, makes an incredibly valuable contribution to the whole process whereby love can be brought to maturity and ultimately to the sacraments. If we compare now these two commentaries on the gradualism principle presented at the 1980 Synod of Bishops with that presented by Zulehner in the wake of the 2015 Synod of Bishops, however, we can see that the same theme of stepwise progress is interpreted a bit different. For Ratzinger, it is a question of pastoral care accompanying the gradual process of conversion with a view to a new and fundamentally radical opening up on man's part to Christ. Here, the Church's teaching on the indissolubility of marriage remains the standard and guarantee of fully human existence. For Zulehner, the Church's teaching is no longer the ultimate norm. So, for Zulehner, place is taken by the individual conscientious decision, which is regarded as advancing gradually towards the ideal of the indissoluble marriage covenant. Whereas Ratzinger pursues a clearly goal-oriented, Christ-centrated pastoral strategy that uses the principle of gradualism, aware of the reality of failure, and embracing it in a way that is both pastoral and pedagogic, Zulehner interprets the same principle of gradualism within a pastoral context that is seen more as an open-end process, accepting and validating elements of goodness in a plurality of forms of marriage and hoping to lead them to maturity. So here the actual goal, so the specific goal, of this ascending curve remains a bit unclear. In 1980, there was still a strong emphasis of conversio. That has now in Zulehner been relegated to the background. We began our symposium with the biblical, and God saw that it was good. In Zulehner's approach, this has become a seeing what is good in broken marriages and analogous relationships, whereas in Ratzinger it is a question of an existential pastoral interiorizing of gradualism in which we see what may gradually become good. The second point, what I consider in the pastoral theology, is based on a theology of failure. It's my second point here, the second bigger point. With the so-called theology of failure, another theological strand comes into play. This also contributes to a change in the pastoral care of marriage after the council, which still viewed marriage within the context of the revival of covenant theology, entirely in the terms of, and God saw what is what that it was good. Faced with the ever-growing number of marriage separations in the second half of the last century, moral and pastoral theology were forced to some extent to rethink the pastoral care of marriage. No longer was marriage seen as a beautiful ideal. It was to be dealt with as a lived reality, vulnerable to failure. Failure always involves pain, the loss of something on which one has pinned one's hope and ideals. The Renaissance poet Paul Fleming put this phenomenon in memorable verses, not without a touch of irony. You permit that I read it in German, then you have the rhyme. And here's an English translation, if it comes. Hello? Sorry. Yeah. Ein Kaufmann, der sein Gut nur einem Schiffe traut, ist hochgefährlich dran, indem es bald kann kommen, dass ihm auf einen Stoß sein Ganzes wird genommen. Der fehlt, der allzu viel auf sein Gelücke traut. Gedenk ich nur an mich, so schauert mir die Haut. Mein Schiff, das ist entzwei, mein Gut ist weggeschwommen. Nichts mehr, das ist mein Rest, das machet kurze Summen. Ich habe Mühe und Angst, ein anderer meine Braut. Ich Unglückseliger, mein Herze wird zerrissen, mein Sinn ist ohne sich, mein Geist zeucht von mir aus, mein Alles wird nun nichts, was wird doch endlich draus? Wär einst doch übrig noch, so wollt ich alles missen, mein teuerster Verlust, der bin selbst selben ich, nun bin ich ohne sie, nun bin ich ohne mich. As in Fleming's poem, the loss and failure is not only a matter of objective distance. The self is plunged into the loss and is lost to itself. Accordingly, there is a strong focus in German writing on pastoral care of marriage in connection with this theology of failure. On the question of the divorced and remarried, this is accompanied by the change in perspective from the utopia of success to the realism of failure, shifting the biblical theology foundations of the pastoral care of marriage. This trend, for example, is heralded, or starts more or less heralded, in Hans-Günter Gruber's 1993 monograph Christliche Ehe in moderner Gesellschaft. He criticizes the excessive elevation, metaphysical and theological, of the concept of love in marriage, in the wake of the council, particularly by Paul VI and John XXIII. This added weight to a tendency already present in society to idealize marriage and thereby create an unrealistic model that expected too much of it. Gruber's view is that the danger involves in the traditional interpretation of the sacrament of marriage imported from covenant theology, were not adverted by this new dynamic understanding of the sacrament of marriage. For him, the juridically narrow understanding of marriage, with its sacramental mystification and its theory of typology, was replaced by the use of overblown religious metaphors of marriage, remote from reality. He proposes that the theology of marriage can be cut loose from the notion of covenant and argues for a new theological orientation on the basis of resurrection, which would see the lived reality of marriage being drawn into the mystery of Christ. This change of perspective, he suggests, would offer a theological interpretation of marriage that is more realistic and adequate to its concrete reality. I quote, just as death real and utter dying, that is, the irreversible collapse of earthly existence, is part of resurrection. It is also part of marriage. Many couples experience this today, perhaps on behalf of others. For Gruber, changing perspective to the death and resurrection of Christ means that the sacramentality of marriage is no longer defined exclusively on the basis of its success, but also on the basis of its failure and collapse. Failure for him is a sign of man's need, to which God responds with the divine offer and healing of salvation. Ultimately, Gruber concedes that we must take seriously the Church's concern, namely that accepting second marriages will weaken marriage and its claim to indissolubility, though empirical evidence for this would need to be gathered. Gruber's argument clearly involves the dissolution of traditional sacrament concept. He suggests cutting marriage loose from the theology of the covenant and giving it a new context in the cross and resurrection. Pastoral theology can counter this argument by showing that the paschal mystery is at its profoundest level a covenant event. This will need more detailed examination later. But there exist also other pastoral voices. In an important contribution to the pastoral care of marriage in 2002, the Freiburg Emeritus Professor Hubert Windisch, he was my professor, examined the sacramentality of marriage in the context of the cross and resurrection. He did not resolve the question by having recourse to the theology of failure. His approach on the very foundations of pastoral theology was to ask this question: what is meant by death and resurrection in a Christian marriage? He wrote this: in even sacrament, there is a dying and a rising. In a Christian marriage, dying involves a conversion from the world's current assumptions so that we may pursue faithfulness, including the sexual sphere. Rising involves the hope of experiencing, through this conversion, a conjugal reality deeper than that which married couples, relying only on themselves, can look forward to. We die in Christian marriage by acknowledging our own poverty vis-à-vis to the other. We rise aware of God's bounteous gifts. Christian married couples reveal their poverty to each other. Each invests the other with their own poverty. They can do this because, through their relationship with Jesus Christ, they continually dare to believe that God alone can transform this shared poverty into fullness and blessing. Poor through their longing for permanence, they live by God's constant faithfulness. In Windisch here, as in Ratzinger's interpretation of gradualism, the element of conversion comes back into focus. I only mention that this theology of failure we saw now comes back into Catholic and Protestant circles as a framework for the pastoral care of marriage. This is now very modern, I would say. At the present time, the theology of failure has even penetrated in the aesthetics of wedding rings. I'll show you an example. No, sorry. Since jeweliers, as here in a photograph from a Freiburg advertisement, now often broken wedding rings under the heading wedding rings for individualists, replacing the ring cast as holes which symbolize consent to an internal and unbroken love. Taking stock. Notwithstanding the theological problem they raise, both changes in the pastoral care of marriage here described, the path of gradualism and the theology of failure, are characterized by a determined pastoral realism. Where pastoral theology really sees, observes, focuses, it can get undeniably close to reality. Realistically, It does not condemn man's weakness, it embraces it. This perhaps is the great attraction of the gradualism principle and of the theology of failure. But a further question arises. Both changes in the pastoral care of marriage presuppose a trust, an energy, a dynamic of growth. Where does it come from? For all proposed solutions, reckon on a dynamism that would indwell and sustain the upward trajectory, whether it be the movement of conversion to God, in Ratzinger, or the stepwise advance in Zulehner, or the overcoming of failure in Gruber. I come to my third and last bigger point, pastoral responses. I want to give two, one in the management, second biblically, and third then to conclude with a picture of Marc Chagall. First, from the sphere of social management. What has the study of social management to offer the pastoral care of marriage at this point? Management is a scientific discipline intimately involved in institutions and institutional life. As such, it cannot be suspected of being remote from reality. Here we shall look at one of the important factors from the field of social management, namely the development of motivation strategies. Only very short. Enterprises can only succeed, also universities, if they have motivated staff. In recent years, there has been a real flood of publications on the subject of heightening motivation. System managers agree that the lack of motivation blocks the performance attitudes and the potential of staff, thus reducing their commitment to the enterprise. Defective motivation is discussed on several levels, only one of them, the personal level. At this level, the consequences of poor motivation are manifested in the cognitional, so like concentration, emotional, like frustration, or psychophysical level, like stress. Significant for the pastoral care of marriage is that these consequences can lead to an internal quitting and can extend to other areas of life. I shorten this. Of course, management and the pastoral care of marriage cannot be equated, but in the latter, including this preparatory phase, is to emerge from the crucible of a theology of failure, we must ask whether the church's pastoral theology is not, in fact, bankrupting itself. Perhaps we need a new pastoral care of marriage along the line of down with low motivation. Management theory can teach us, at all events, that strengthening the will is a decisive factor in motivation. Strengthening the couple's will to follow the path of marriage would be a really important task for pastoral care of marriage, attuned to growth dynamics. Its aim would be to identify as soon as possible and deal with the fear of marriage commitment and forestall that slip-sliding, secret quitting of marriage that it itself a resultat of poor motivation, arising from the prospect of potential failure. Then second, utopian jubilation, a change of paradigm. As we have seen from social management theory, motivation can be undermined by an overemphasis of the theology of failure. We now move on to a second biblically based reflection from pastoral theology that refers more to the idea of gradualism and the question of the ascending dynamic it implies. Our starting point is the second account of creation as found as in the Bible. We heard something about from Dollner last day. The man can find no equal partner in the animal's kingdom. In his loneliness, he is almost depressed. At this point, the Lord God presents the woman to him, and Adam utters the famous words, "This now is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." The first utterance in the whole Bible in its established canonical form, is man's rejoicing over his delight in the woman. Disaster follows very swiftly in the fall, failure. But the whole biblical response to marriage is the jubilus, the free ecstatic expression of delight. In salvation history, marriage is and remains under the sign of the jubilus, something that draws the human being beyond his earthly reality. Eros is what the Greeks would call it. In his encyclical Deus Caritas Est, Benedict XVI paraphrases Eros as the power that pulls us out of ourselves towards the divine, that wants to take us beyond ourselves. At the same time, in the ecstasy and euphoria, there is always the need for purification and healing through a descending movement of self-giving agape, for it is these two dimensions of love that create and guarantee its unity. We spoke about it, Eros and agape. Fundamentally, in fact, the jubilus expresses both. Eros, so Ratzinger, is initially and primarily an ascending desire, exercising a huge fascination by its prospect of happiness. But as it moves towards the other, it thinks less and less of itself, desiring rather the happiness of the other, caring, giving, being there for the other. In other words, if it is to be holy and entirely jubilous and not merely ecstatic mood music, the ecstasy that draws us upwards must be complemented by the descending movement of self-giving. The melodic structure of the jubilus is always both dodim and ahaba. In the love terminology of the Song of Songs, the pure jubilus no longer seeks itself and the inebriation of love. Now love desires the good for the beloved. It has become a renunciation ready for sacrifice. This is now what it wishes. In this way, the jubilus contains one component of the spiritual canticle superbly written by John of the Cross, where in the ninth stanza he speaks of love wounding and letting itself be wounded. I quote this in English. Why, after wounding this heart, have you not healed it? And why, after stealing it, have you thus abandoned it and not carried away the stolen prey? Might not the jubilus give us a new starting point, a new paradigm for the pastoral care of marriage, understood as a journey? Could it not provide a counter melody, so to speak, to the funeral death march of failure? In the pastoral care of marriage, overemphasizing failure imposes an unnatural burden on the couples, making it all harder for them, not easier, to take the step toward lifelong faithfulness. How can the pastoral care of marriage regain the carefree energy of the psalmist who says, "By my God, I can leap over wall," especially when faced with so many failed marriages? In his discussion, Christian Marriage Today, Windisch points out that Jesus' introduction on marriage is grounded on the realism of creation. In addition to the obligation of lifelong union, it recalls the whole context of Genesis 2, including the man's delight in the woman and the couple's complementarity and mutual help. This jubilus, this soaring eros uttered by the first human being, is echoed in the Old Testament's Song of Song, that collection of lyrical love poems that never tires to describe the beauty of love and the beauty of the beloved. There is nothing utopian or unworldly about the jubilus. The Song of Song explicitly acknowledges love's dark places, the way it vanishes in the streets and squares at night, the way it is scalded by the town watchman, and how it evaporates in the morning. The Song of Song is characterized by an astonishing realism. It does not prettify the relationship of the lovers, but affirms their beauty even in their limitations. I am black but comely. It rebuffs those who would scorn their imperfections. Do not gaze at me because I'm swarthy, because the sun has scorched me. This verse prompted the church fathers, beginning with Origen, to create a particular theology of negritudo, in which human sinfulness, while always tending towards disaster, never has the last word, but is overcome by a beauty of Christ in his dying and rising. So too, Gruber's stark opposition between covenant theology and the theology of the cross is unnecessary, since both are integrated in the Paschal mystery. The new covenant is effected in the blood of Christ. It proceeds from the cross and attains its fulfillment in the resurrection. His death on the cross and his resurrection are, at the deepest level, covenant events, in which God's covenant with man is sealed definitively in his Son. The marriage covenant, therefore, is an image of God, covenant, and at the same time a participation in cross and resurrection. Does this mean that cross and resurrection are opposed to the jubilus, the soaring eros? No, because to take up another reflection from Ratzinger's theology of marriage, it is only in the context of cross and resurrection that eros attains its full form. He says, eros too participates in the mystery of the cross. It only becomes its full mature self in the crucified one, in the crucifying of the I, in being integrated into God's loving covenant, in forgiving and giving, in seeing oneself as a guilty party, while at the same time recognizing the good in oneself. Because of the nature of the human being, eros and sex must be inserted into the mystery of cross and resurrection. In marriage, they must be taken up and transformed into the sacrament in which the married couple themselves become the matter. In concrete terms, married love is only possible if it is a forgiving, supportive love that permits itself to be crucified. And this, in turn, is only possible on the basis of faith through grace. At its deepest level, the pastoral care of marriage is a pastoral care of faith. For the core of today's marriage crisis in the church is the widespread lack of deterioration of a relation to Christ, even in sacramentally celebrated marriages. This crisis of faith has broadened, so to speak, into marriage crisis. It follows that the renewal of the pastoral care of marriage would need to proceed in tandem with the renewal of a pastoral faith or the faith itself. This would give the jubilus a new sphere of resonance. Let me conclude by illustrating this very shortly now by reference on one of the Marc Chagall's painting. Third, last point, and the third bigger point, seeing things a new way with Marc Chagall. In the Marc Chagall Museum in Nice hangs a five-part circle of prominently red-toned paintings on the subject of the Song of Songs. It was created by the Jewish painter in the middle of the 20th century. The fourth picture we see here, undertitled Draw Me After You, Let Us Hurry, sets the scene for what we have described as a change of paradigm in the pastoral care of marriage, from failure to jubilus. For Klaus Meyer, the love that infuses these pictures is heightened to the divine dimensions, to God himself. What dominates, you see that in the painting, is the flying horse in the center. It is a mystical reference to the legend of Pegasus and announces the theme, namely the love that soars upwards, the ascending jubilus, the eros of love that goes beyond itself. This main motif is framed right and left by two figures that indicate transcendence or transcendent love. On the right, we see a woman suspended in the air, being drawn up by her hair from the earthly realm to the supernatural. Man's yearning to be lifted beyond himself to transcend is emphasized by the birds, which fly upside down near her, their wings still folded. All this speaks of a higher, of a better, of a more beautiful world, with its own possibilities and parameters, the world of love. On the upper left, we find, in contrary direction, an angel flying down from heaven, blowing a shofar, proclaiming shalom, peace. In these side figures moving upwards to the right and downwards to the left, we have a very strong expression of the mutual involvement of earthly and heavenly reality. What we see here is energetic communication and interaction. The two realms interpenetrate, for there is only one world, God's world. However, this one world, God's world, is torn, the result of man's sin. So the earthly realm, having lost its original harmony, needs healing, redeeming, perfecting. But in spite of humanity's brokenness, its failure, the people in the lower third of the picture are still able to be elevated and inspired by the jubilus of the Song of Songs love. They are singing not only to the bridal couple on this horse, not only for the love of man and woman. Rather, their song is praise of him who created man and women and designed each for other. In the midst of the people, here a bit nearer, in their ecstasy of love, praising and thanksgiving God, we see the artist himself with his palette. Perhaps you see it. He has a bit of colors on it. The gesture his hand makes is surely to be seen as an invitation to reflect on the picture and to usurp its meaning. Even as an old man, Marc Chagall did not lose hope in the fascination that love inspires. His painting, saturated with the jubilus, radiates the power of hope that could lend wings to the pastoral care of marriage. Sustained by the paradigm of the jubilus, this would be a realistic pastoral care of hope and trust in the power of love with its dynamism that points beyond itself and that ascending is met and embraced by the loving care that descends from God. In the paradigm of the jubilus, which is most definitely not a pastoral utopia out of a painful reality, is joined to that ascending trust that is love in its potential for transcendence. In such a context, the pastoral care of marriage could see its role as giving people courage to sing the jubilus, also with the dark places, which celebrates both cross and resurrection in the song of the new covenant. Thank you for your attention.